white plaster walls of two or three rooms in one of the buildings. These paintings were nearly life-size depictions of German soldiers in various uniforms, engaged in various activities. The spirit of the drawings, of the drawing, was very reminiscent of our own Rockwell. And were almost comparable to Rockwell in the skill in which, with which the activities of the soldiers were depicted. I was particularly reminded of Rockwell's Yankee Doodle painting, which combined accuracy of draftsmanship with humor. Regrettably, we had no cameras and were never able to visit the place again. Louis Fieser had come over with special objectives and did not stay very long. However, he was more heavily equipped than most of us. In particular, he carried a swagger stick with a dagger concealed in it. I remember one night in a house in central Germany. The house had no electricity, and half a dozen of us were sitting on the floor of a second-story room with one candle as the only light. Someone had come upon a monocle in the course of his searches for papers. Louis acquired this monocle, screwed it into his eye, and gave an exhibition of what all of us regarded as the action and speech of a Prussian officer. Louis was a good companion as well as a fine organic chemist. One of my many weaknesses is a passion for opera. In spite of the war, the Opera Comique was running in Paris, but I had been unable to get to it. Finally, we worked a 7-day week, but on Sundays, knocked off at 4 o'clock. So I decided, quietly, it was impossible to get dinner at the hotel before the opera. So I went down directly from the office after 4 o'clock and found a small restaurant where a little food was available. It proved to be some sort of underdone meat hash, which at best was probably horse meat. I went from here to the opera and found the house, the opera house, dimly lighted and unheated. It was fairly full. The audience clad in winter overcoats. So, of course, I kept my heavy lined trench coat on, as well as keeping my head covered and my scarf on. The house resounded with coughing and sneezing, and most of the singers had sore throats. And really, that part of it really did not matter much, as the opera was an unknown opera by a composer unknown to me, in spite of a fairly considerable familiarity on my part with French opera. I stayed, however, till the end, and apparently picked up one of the bad colds prevalent in the house. This was unfortunate in the extreme, as a couple of days later, word reached Alsace that General George Patton was crossing the Rhine 2 nights later. Although I had been slated to go into Germany at farther down the Rhine, it seemed best to go wherever the opportunity occurred. Those in authority had no objection to my joining the group scheduled, set up to go with Patton's army. However, rough going was expected, and it seemed unwise for me with a bad cold to hazard my previously allotted mission, or possibly spending a night or two in the open during the Rhine crossing. I therefore decided not to go along, and was glad of my decision later when I found that the Alsace group spent the first night on the floor of a windowless schoolhouse. The windows having been shattered by the violence of Patton's artillery bombardment prior to crossing. Graf. His first Rhine crossing in force occurred on the night of March 22nd, 9 days after my arrival in Paris. Cologne, on the west bank of the Rhine, had been entered by American troops on March 7th, 2 weeks earlier, and Bonn had been taken very shortly thereafter. Much of my work in Paris had consisted of study of papers brought by Alsace from laboratories in Cologne and Bonn. It was thought that more could be learned by repeating the visit to Cologne. Consequently, it was decided that I should go down to Aachen, where Alsace had set up a small forward base in a house on the outskirts of the city. From there, it would be possible to move quickly into the Ruhr if it should become accessible. March 27th, a dark, chill, rainy morning, I was to take off for Aachen. I believe that my jeep was accompanied by a second, but I am a little bit rusty in the matter. When we had loaded the jeep with our bedding rolls, Colonel Pash and Dr. Goudsmit came down to the street in front of the hotel to see us off. This was the real start of what I had come over to do. Garsmith even went so far as to offer me the loan of the pair of sheets which he had carried. He said they had been used only once, and I was very much touched, but felt that I would be more comfortable swathed directly in my own blankets, and saw no reason in any case why I should use his sheets. So we took off. As we progressed forward, roughly east-northeast, we soon entered territory which had been the major battlefield of World War I. As we went along, we saw German prisoners working on the road under the watchful eye of black American GIs, who were very spruce and military in their appearance. In the vicinity of Arras, A-R-R-A-S, a familiar name for the First World War, we lost our way. There were no markings. There were no normal road signs on the highways, as they had been removed to make the going rough for the Germans if they should get back. In a few places, there were signs pointing the way to American bases. I recall with amusement seeing one sign labeled, quote, Superior Charlie, end of quote. I knew that this was not designed as a compliment to me, but was entertained to find such a sign. In the vicinity of Arras, where we had lost our way, we wandered in fog and unexpectedly found ourselves out on the runway of a landing field. Several planes became visible through the fog, and we knew that was not the place for us, wherever we might be. The Alsace mission had not come to Paris merely to interpret information, but to obtain it. And we now knew that the information we most needed was in Germany. We had obtained materials when Strasbourg fell, and recently had been able to get into Cologne. But our main interest was in getting into Germany. The first Allied troops across the Rhine had gotten there 6 days before our arrival in Paris. And we're holding on with some difficulty. I had been told that I should go into the Ruhr region, where a vast amount of information might be expected to lie. However, I could not go there until General Montgomery, who was in command of the northern part of our army, near or along the Rhine, had decided that he had sufficient supplies and troops to make a sure thing of it. I therefore waited in Paris for something to happen. It was interesting to observe what went on in Paris. The streets had little traffic, and most of that consisted of American military vehicles, jeeps, and trucks. Some British, a few cars belonging to the Free French, and these cars drove around at high speed, occupied by young men, obviously exhilarated by the thought of nearby victory. They were, however, somewhat reminiscent of the cars full of brown-shirted Nazis that I had seen on German streets in 1937. Many of the French cars were wood burners. That is, they had large cylinders on the back into which fuel was placed in the form of wooden cubes about 2 inches on the edge. When the car was started, some sort of heating process was applied to vaporize material, to distill the wood destructively so that the gases could be fed into the cylinders of the engine and take the place of gasoline vapor. I was told that the wood burning equipment added roughly 50% to the weight of the car and about the same to the cost. It was not a device to be recommended under ordinary conditions. Life in Paris was not too bad. Very few restaurants were open, and we were not supposed to frequent them in any case. We ate three meals a day in the dining room of the Royal Monceau Hotel, where we were quartered. The food was the usual government issue food. The chefs of the hotel did nothing to improve the food, which was not bad, but did not show any extraordinary touch, such as is usually attributed to a French chef. The waiters were mostly teenage boys in shabby old dress clothes. The food was served in metal dishes with lids and looked very imposing until the lids were taken off. But it supplied life, it sustained life, and was not at all bad. The dining room was an interesting place with a variety of officers and an occasional civilian. Among the latter, Noel Coward appeared once, and among the former, Charles Lindbergh was recognizable. The work at the office went on from early morning till very late afternoon, 7 days a week, except on Sunday when it closed early, when the office closed early at about 4:30. Paragraph. We were able to go occasionally in the evening to entertainment provided for the troops. In one case, this consisted of Bernard Shaw's Arms and the Man, played by the Lunts. Once I was able to satisfy my craving for opera by going to the Opera Comique of a Sunday evening when I got off sufficiently early from work to pick up a bite to eat and get to